You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Captain America by James Pogue. Confront power, but leaders will see themselves better. It will all work out. It probably says more about the Democratic Party than it does about Mamdani that he has shaken the party's establishment as much as he has. Many people who came to support Mamdani are simply fed up to the point that they are no longer interested in hearing dire predictions of what might happen if his tax increases drive wealthy residents to Florida. And the irony is that if this does happen, a whole genre of memes being passed around tech and finance circles these days has pictures like one of Mamdani with Bernie Sanders and AOC captioned with things like, "The last thing you see before your business moves to Miami." It may be that few of his voters actually care. I spoke to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent the day after I met Mamdani. He told me that he thought the manifest unfairness of this system had opened a door for Mamdani. "They are going to come and take it," he said, "like if you don't fix the way the system is built." He did not think Mamdani's redistributionist project would actually work. But provoking a capital flight and a crash in the real estate market might very well end up being a real way to tackle the affordability issue. Not that anyone would ever exactly say this. "I kind of like Mamdani winning," Bessent said, "because the worst thing in a way would be when Cuomo comes back in. You just keep losing a little bit of altitude for 4 or 8 more years. And they kind of hold it together and more people leave. So if you could just say, okay, he's a shock to the system and there's a chance you can come back from it." In the time after Kirk was assassinated, Americans now seem to be convinced we are at a breaking point. Mamdani doesn't seem to see it this way. He had, in 2023, signed a letter in opposition to a Kirk event, calling him a far-right extremist. But Mamdani has tried to adopt the role of conciliator. Rahim, his PR person, would describe this as arising from a sense of ummah, the feeling of brotherhood and unity among the Muslim faithful. He made one famous video in which he asked Trump-voting New Yorkers what had driven them to the right. And just after Kirk's death, he tied the murder to the killing of Palestinians in a picture of the universal values that are at the core of his whole politics. It cannot be a question of political agreement or alignment that allows us to mourn, he said. It must be the shared notion of humanity that binds us all. This positioning is growing increasingly difficult for prominent politicians on either side of our divide, and it can be particularly difficult in radical-tinged spheres like the New York left, where so many see ideological purity as a point of pride. I ask Mamdani how he had survived the blood sport this type of politics had become during the years when he'd emerged as a political figure. "Come on," I said. "America deserves to know," he laughed. He said that he hadn't really lived through this kind of thing. "You'll call this careful," he said, "but I think it's honest and direct. When you have run a paid canvas operation, like I did for the Najmi campaign, it becomes very tempting to work backwards from the IDs you need per shift." He'd become a political operative so young that all he knew was practical politics. I brought up the Kennedy comparison, if only because without a base in DSA and the left to elevate him, I was curious how he'd managed to rise in politics in the first place. "Is that where you're going to go?" he said, laughing. and possibly flattered. I clarified that I didn't mean it as praise exactly. I meant the combination of the privileged background, the dash and charm, along with the real politics stuff of winning over unions one steward at a time, and texting influential black preachers over and over until they agree to let you come and talk. No one is born with this network or skill set. He insisted he really had come up through shoe leather politics, but he had also captured a cultural moment. My path to the Muslim Democratic Club of New York was because I listened to Heems, he said, adumbrating a rap lyric. I was like, oh, this is great. I should get on the F train and go to the second to the last stop and door knock for Ali Najmi, he said. I remember going with Ali on election day, he said, and going to Dunkin' Donuts, getting donuts, giving them to the poll workers, and the sadness of him losing that election. It was such a distinctly New York image. The donuts on a sad day, the getting into something because you heard an indie rapper talking about it, the ethnic politics. The entire Mamdani project, in fact, is idiosyncratic and specific to the international center New York has always been. I found myself asking whether or not he is worried by the prospect of governing now that he's been cast as a face of the left. For as much as this is an immense responsibility, Mamdani told me, it is also an opportunity and one that deeply excites me, the prospect of delivering on this agenda. People speak to me as if the campaign was one thing and then governing must be another. My job is to deliver on the promises that I have made. These are not anchors that I view tying my feet down. These are North Stars that I will wake up every morning and head towards. This is just how he talks. The issue that draws him to speak unguardedly is Palestine. This is a city that is an international city. 40%, as I was telling you, of its residents were born elsewhere, he said to me. He had just announced that his NYPD would arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu if he set foot in New York. New Yorkers have watched in horror as we have seen Netanyahu orchestrate a genocide of Palestinians and do so violating international law, and even coming here to New York City to take military decisions that kill civilians, Mamdani told me. And what I've found is that the horror that New Yorkers have for it is a horror that I have heard about, no matter what borough I'm in, no matter what age the New Yorker is that I'm speaking to, and no matter their race or religion. People are, Mamdani said, simply in shock as to the lack of accountability and response from so many with so much power. I think that the fact that he's a brown person who speaks to all these marginalized communities in a place like New York is a part of the difference between him and Bernie, Ratajkowski told me. The appeal that the left makes to blue-collar workers and white guys and the Bernie bros, that's not a bad thing. But I think for Mamdani, that wasn't his path. He may have brought these people in, but that wasn't necessarily his base. That's not where he started. Donald Trump got elected because of the price of eggs, or something that is as sort of tangible as that, she continued. Mamdani is saying, okay, the price of rent, the price of living in New York City is just abysmal for everyone, and I'm going to address that, and I'm going to talk about it head on. I absolutely think we can reach each and every New Yorker, Mamdani told me, and have conversations and go out into neighborhoods where we did not win that vote, where we are engaging with skepticism and questions, if not even downright opposition. This is, in some sense, the grandest and most radical political vision of our whole age, that all the seemingly irreconcilable and rage-fueled divisions about where this country should be headed really could be reconciled by a simple, relentless focus on affordability. Last Stand. Richard Prince has shocked the cultural establishment again and again with norm-breaking, some say law-breaking, conceptual artworks. But since the pandemic, he's been holed up in his Hamptons home, rarely making appearances. In an unprecedented interview late in his career, he spills to Nate Freeman about the surprising new series he calls Folk Songs and his six-hour film, Deposition. And for the first time, he discusses what will happen to his estate after he's gone. Opening photograph by Taryn Simon, which shows Richard Prince dressed in a suit and lying on the beach. In another photo, Untitled Folk Songs 2022, Richard Prince's new work will be shown for the first time in November at the Gagosian Gallery. It was a Saturday in July, perfect weather in Sagaponack, and Richard Prince walked to the door of his beach house wearing a shirt with one of his hippie drawings. He had on beat-up khakis and sneakers without socks. There was golf on the TV, paintings of flowers and birds and seashells on the walls. Prince has been out east for a while. He got property in this secluded spot in the 90s when he followed his friend Glenn O'Brien to the houses near potato fields. It was pretty empty then, and collectors Don and Mira Rubel had a place nearby, so they would all get lunch. Later, Prince spent summers here with his family. Boogie boards and a surfboard his kids used growing up were leaning on the deck, filthy. They didn't get to use them much anyway. The breaks off Wainscott Beach aren't shit, Prince said. He wanted to bring me to the guest house he converted to a studio. I was excited. I'd be maybe the third person to see his first completely new series of work since 2018. It has a great name, like all his best series. Girlfriends, Hoods, Nurses, Cowboys, Jokes. These new works are called folk songs. As he enters his late 70s, Prince is now the greatest living artist depicting the good, the bad, and the ugly of cultural Americana. Not quite half a century ago, he shocked the art world with brazen acts of appropriation, rephotographing the Cowboys and Marlboro cigarette ads, and blowing the results up into his own art, modifying the source material. Those works now sell for more than $3 million at auction, making them among the most expensive photographs in history. His paintings sell for more. In 2021, Prince's Runaway Nurse, a painting over an inkjet print of a pulp novel on canvas, sold for more than $12 million. As he's gotten older, he's built out the Prince business as a Geschmackkunstwerk. There's the art, a books collection that's an artwork in and of itself, the operational body shop, churning out trucks, the merch, the weed vape pens, and what's perhaps his grand opus, a town-sized series of buildings, a sculptures, in a remote part of the Catskills. After a career of constantly breaking the rules, and in the mind of some, the law, Prince's omnivorous eye has become a gold standard for American art. He's a genius, there's no doubt about it, said Larry Gagosian, the world's most prominent art dealer, who's featured Prince solo shows at his global network of galleries 23 times in 20 years. He's one of the great artists of his generation, and maybe the defining cultural artist. I mean, you have to think of an artist like Warhol. That's pretty good company. Over and over, Prince has transformed. After painting jokes on monochromatic canvases, he painted car hoods. He meddled in the legacy of de Kooning, Klein, and Pollock. After his scandalous Instagram portraits, he made High Times, large-scale, colorful paintings celebrating the 1960s. Prince is not that easy to get hold of. Before we chatted, he hadn't given an extended interview in more than a decade. He isn't planning on giving any more after this one. He's had a health scare. Since 2020, he's been mostly at his Hamptons home, doing work in isolation. He isn't a recluse on the level of, say, J.D. Salinger, whose work Prince has appropriated in the past. Prince still has a place in the city, two connected townhouses perched on a desirable east side block dotted with blue-chip galleries. Edward Hopper's chair car hangs over the fireplace in his kitchen. Downstairs is a maybe Pollock with a disputed provenance. There's a piece from Warhol's little-known retrospective series that shows the Pope of Pop in a rare contemplative mode, mashing up his most famous series. Prince and Warhol share a birthday, 21 years apart. The townhouses also have part of his rare books collection, which the book dealer Matt Schuster has called the finest of its kind in the United States. Richard Prince's book collection might be his best work, Schuster said. It's not just source material, it's his worldview, a private club with one member. And he has a few hundred acres upstate, where he's installed vast sculptural works, storage facilities, hangar-sized gallery spaces, and a house shingled with vinyl records and a disco ball, once owned by James Brown, inside. The Hamptons is a good place to play art world bingo. I had a full dance card that evening. I told Prince that Joe Bradley and Valentina Ackerman were holding a dinner at their Amagansett art space, Gallery Sardine, for new work by Nate Lohman. Prince was intrigued. He's collected Bradley's work and Lohman's. When I later told Lohman and Bradley that Prince said hello, they were slightly agog. You saw him? In person? No one had in a while. Apart from shooting 18 holes at the Bridge, one of the world's most expensive golf clubs, he's been mostly up in his studio, working like mad, with no assistance, just painting away. Listen, Richard barely noticed COVID, said Bob Rubin, who founded the Bridge in 2002. I mean, it had the least impact on him. He kind of keeps to himself anyway. Prince has been playing golf since he chased down balls at the Hyannisport Club in the 60s. As a malcontent teenager, he was keeping grounds right next to the Kennedy compound in Hyannis. There was a rumor that even among those willing to spend $1.5 million to join the Bridge, Prince won the club championship one year. He won the senior club championship. Let's not get carried away, Rubin said. Next photo, contact high. Prince's last series, High Times, including the work Untitled, 2017, which is pictured here, got rave reviews and already felt like a coda to a career. A selection of Prince's new work will be shown at Gagosian in November. Even for Prince, who's made a career of departures, it's a departure. It explores mortality, the unknown, and folk art. This idea of making things, but not necessarily calling them art, I do that a lot, he told me, and sometimes what I make remains just the making of it, but sometimes what I make does turn into art. The series began with the gigantic rubber-blasting mats he found upstate and installed on his property as just that, not art, just the making of it. One night, he heard the wind going through the rubber and it made a squeak. A song through the folk art. A folk song. He started making new paintings. He brought in garish motifs, bloody mouths with appropriated cigarettes, inkjet printed onto them, the trail of smoke making an abex swirl hula-hooping through the canvas. Then there's the surfers, the figurines hanging tin, also inkjet printed with the ripple of wake painted behind the figures. Some of these paintings are massive. A lot of this work has been in the racks for a couple of years before the train got in, he said. He went off on the train thing and how it relates to the history of the folk movement, something he was on the ground floor of in the 60s. I'm not sure when I thought about the train or looked at the train, but I remember the train being part of the Dust Bowl. Woody Guthrie, the hobo, There were a bunch of trains. On the Cisco Houston album, there's a train. And whatever is inherent in that name, whatever the name suggests, folk songs, whether it suggests acoustic guitars or protest, that's part of it for me. I wondered who else has seen this indelibly Princeian but radically different new work that will also no doubt make people quite angry. I've shown this to maybe three or four people so far, really, he said. I've shown the folk songs to one other artist, and I did show it to Larry. When asked about the perhaps unexpectedly dark nature of the new works, Gagosian said, I can't wait for the show. I think people are going to really be fascinated by this work, and puzzled by it, and enthralled, and all those things. I can't wait to see it on the wall. When Prince in 2017 unveiled his previous new series, High Times, it already felt like a coda to a career. In a rave, the New York Times praised it as one of his best. This coda to the coda will kick off an enormously busy 12 months for any artist, but especially one approaching his late 70s. Every time I go to the studio, there's something new, and Richard is always making work daily, said Nancy Spector, who put together the Prince retrospective, Spiritual America, that took over the entirety of the Guggenheim in 2007. There's no way that he can't make work. So there's so many series, some of which have probably never been seen by the public. In May, Prince will be part of a two-person show with Arthur Jaffa, curated by Spector, that will take over the Fondazione Prada in Venice. Jaffa, a fellow appropriation artist, once said, Richard Prince is clearly the blackest white artist out here. Later next year, he'll take over Museo Humex, the David Chipperfield-designed private museum founded by art-collecting fruit juice billionaire Eugenio Lopez Alonso. His show at Max Hetzler's remote West Texas space in Marfa features works from Prince's poster series, until December. This past summer, a new work by Prince was installed in a 1,000-year-old church in Rome, put down right where the altar used to be. It is the first Prince work in the medium of film. It is nearly 7 hours long. The artist himself is on screen the entire time. The film is appropriated footage of the artist giving a deposition after being sued for allegedly appropriating commercial photography in his art. He calls it deposition. He's an anarchist, said Gavin Brown, the dealer who staged the show at his Sant'Andrea di Scafi space in Rome's Trastevere district, and who is a partner at Gladstone, the gallery founded by Barbara Gladstone, one of Prince's early devotees. Brown's enthusiasm for art is legendary, but I've never seen him quite this animated by love for a single artwork. He thinks Deposition is one of the great artworks of our era, and one that, in its conceptual rigor and imposing length, is something of a key to the entire Prince ecosystem. It's the first time where you feel Richard Prince is wearing his heart on his sleeve, Brown said. But then you wonder, is it his sleeve, or just a photograph of somebody else's sleeve? For years, Prince has been publishing essays, first as zines, then books, then in what he called his bird talk, and eventually he just started putting everything on Twitter. The account still exists, but it's mostly retweets of anti-Trump talking heads. Lots of material about his life, some of it real, some of it fake, some of it true, some of it lies. Prince heads are wont to remind you there was a Robert Zimmerman and there was a Bob Dylan. Prince shares Dylan's penchant for weaving in the real and the artifice. In the Prince ecosystem, there are nom de art and nom de plume, genders blurred in social media handles, matryoshka dolls of LLCs within companies that sometimes have legit business storefronts. Here's a primer. Prince was born, he has said, in the Panama Canal Zone to parents in the proto-CIA. He sent me his passport. It looks real. His parents were apparently OSS agents. A source close to him said he recently took a trip back to Panama to revisit his roots and keeps a picture of a cobblestone street in the old Gorgona district of the Canal Zone on a shelf of his cherished objects in his upstate studio. His family moved outside of Boston when he was young, and his Masshole accent is still remarkably intact. Idea is idea, and so on. He grew his hair long. He spent time in California, missed Monterey Pop, but saw the Doors at the Whiskey. I met someone on the street on Sunset, went up to a party in Laurel Canyon that evening, and then did some hits, as he put it. He went back to Boston, fought with his parents, skated through school, hitchhiked to Woodstock, but left before Jimi Hendrix played, smoked a lot of dope, and developed a healthy skepticism toward the establishment. He always had a gift for draftsmanship. After enrolling at a third-rate liberal arts school in Maine, he befriended the art teacher, who took him under his wing. He taught pottery to middle school students in Massachusetts. While house-sitting, he read a magazine article about artists in Soho, so he moved to New York, lived in a shithole at Prince and West Broadway, and took drawing classes at Broom and Mercer. The next year, he got a job at the Time Life building, collating pages from the magazines, and in 1976, staged a guerrilla show in the basement, where he placed four magazine covers on four sides of the table: Time, Cosmopolitan, Photo, People. No one saw the work, but he documented the installation with photography. This got him to the idea of the original copy. A photograph of the magazine would be the object. The camera was an electric scissor, an 8-track recording tape, a beat maker. In 1977, he took pictures of furniture company advertisements from the New York Times magazine and created the artwork untitled Living Rooms. To Prince, depicting something that already exists is as close as you can get to true art because it's real. So he started taking pictures of cowboys and cigarette ads. I've always liked the idea of taking as much subjectivity out of the image, or interpretation, which is what usually is associated with art, he told me. What I'd like to do is take that out so that I don't have to have it. Someone doesn't even have to really weigh in. You sort of remove the umpire, the critic, the opinion. There is none of that. This continued for years as he expanded his vision of appropriation. Metro Pictures opened in 1980, and he showed there and at the East Village Gallery International with Monument, along with other artists who came to be associated with the pictures generation: Robert Longo, Laurie Simmons, Sherry Levine, Cindy Sherman, Louise Lawler, Barbara Kruger, and Sarah Charlesworth. After bumming around the West Side, Prince moved to the East Village. I lived in the same building with Allen Ginsberg. I just didn't want to bother. I should have. I wish I had. He lived five floors above me or whatever. Hey, Allen, can you come in and sign one of your poetry? I just don't have that, whatever that is. He did meet fellow East Village resident Jeff Koons. They hit it off and drank beer and talked to girls at a no-frills joint called Red Bar at 7th Street and 1st Avenue. They were both working on radical ideas. In the years that followed, Koons would start his lifelong transubstantiation of the humble, inflatable toy rabbit into what would become a 91 million Uber Duchampian icon. No one would show him. Koons is now the most expensive living artist. Prince got the work immediately. Jeff Koons was the first artist that I met that, when I saw his work, I thought, this guy's making art like I wanted it to be made, Prince once wrote. We probably would hit almost every bar and just have a beer. Any bar below 14th Street at some point, we probably visited at one time or another, Koons said when I spoke to him in September. I think everybody enjoyed beer, and we enjoyed sitting around and talking about art. Kunz, who then was working a day job at the membership desk at MoMA, saved his museum wages to buy two essential early prints works, Single Man Looking to the Right and Golden Acorns. I think Richard is really the real deal, and we are of the same kind of a generation, Kunz said. We're alive, we're functioning. I think our love of art and our commitment to art is very similar. Prince didn't get the press lauded upon the likes of Julian Schnabel, David Sally, and Ross Blechner. The things were happening, but things were happening. Untitled Woman with Compact was on the cover of Hal Foster's The Anti-Aesthetic, Essays on Postmodern Culture, the defining art treatise of the era. Stephen Meisel staged a photo shoot on Prince's bed for a young singer named Madonna. He rented a room to the actor who played Laura Palmer in Twin Peaks. He hung out with Dyke Blair at the Mud Club. He started making the cowboys. Nobody bought them. In 1983, he re-photographed an image by Gary Gross of a naked 10-year-old Brooke Shields and turned it into an appropriation work he called Spiritual America. In 2005, Shields, a noted arts philanthropist, collaborated with Prince on an updated version of the work by posing, this time clothed, in front of a motorcycle. Metro Pictures declined to show it, so he opened his own gallery called Spiritual America at 5 Rivington Street. Prince was essentially cast out from the art world, so he moved to California and made re-photographs of ads with red and orange that looked vaguely like the end of the world. He called them sunsets. It wasn't about the money. He never knew any sold until he saw one while watching Lena Dunham's film Tiny Furniture. Her parents, Laurie Simmons and Carol Dunham, had one on the wall of their DeBrosse Street loft. It turns out Carol Dunham saw the sunset work up at Metro Pictures and had to have it, and spent what was a lot of money to him at the time to get it. When I saw them all together, I loved them and thought they were a big development in his work, he told me. I had a job then and a steady paycheck. I really wanted to get one, so I did. Never regretted that, although it felt like a stretch at the time. It was hanging in our loft on Broadway in Soho forever, Simmons said, chiming in on the group chat. The kids grew up with it. Yes, Dunham said, still a cherished possession. Next photo. Photoplay. Untitled Self-Portrait, 1980. Prince believes that depicting something that already exists is the closest thing to true art because it's real. He moved back to the city and into the back space at 303 Gallery, which was run by the art dealer and later his wife, Lisa Spellman. In 1987, he got a loft on Reed Street. For a few years, he had been making these strange works on paper, just handwritten jokes on a specific thick cardstock. I never had a penny to my name, so I changed my name. I went to see a psychiatrist. He said, tell me everything. I did, and now he's doing my act. In the loft, he found he could paint the text against a monochromatic background. People started taking the jokes seriously, and thus began his first ever period of any kind of commercial success. By 1992, he was firmly in Barbara Gladstone's stable. She was selling his work for more than $160,000 in today's cash. That year, he had a survey at the Whitney and a dozen works in the epoch-defining documents show in Kassel, Germany. Smash commercial success really came a decade later, when Prince began a new series he dubbed Nurses. Working with the Hamptons-based rare book dealer John McWinney, Prince started buying pulp fiction paperbacks featuring women in various guises, buying them at used bookstores, pulp purveyors, flea markets. He inkjet printed them onto canvas and then painted over them. The nurses were an immediate hit and started getting flipped for insanely high prices. A few years after the first were shown at a gallery, Overseas Nurse sold for more than $8 million at Sotheby's. The record for a nurse stands at more than $12 million, putting Prince in a very small club of living artists with work that has sold for eight figures. Among them, Koons, David Hockney, Gerhard Richter, Peter Doig, his old East Village pal Christopher Wool, and Damien Hirst, an artist Prince collects in depth. That should have been Prince's ultimate crossover moment. The nurses brought collaborations with Marc Jacobs and photo shoots with Kate Moss. But a decade later, he got into social media through his kids. He watched how his daughter got absolutely addicted to a photo sharing app called Instagram. Back in the day, Prince would do this thing where he commissioned portraits by asking folks for three pictures of themselves that they liked. He chose one to re-photograph, and that was the artwork. He found the feed of the model Jessica Hart and liked a photo of Hart in big fur boots, standing in front of a picture of Brigitte Bardot. "I told her, someone should make a portrait out of this photo," Prince wrote in 2014. She said, "Why don't you?" The Instagram portraits are really what I call my hit record, and I never had a hit record, he told me in the studio in July. "You just can't make that up, and you certainly can't control it. I wasn't prepared for the reaction." The series was called, with neo-Koonsian banality, New Portraits. It came out of the Instagram paper printouts sold through the gallery Karma in Amagansett in the summer of 2013 for $12 a pop. By early 2014, he was ready to treat them as artworks in a white cube. And on September 19th, a new body of work arrived sans faire fair in a gallery behind Gagosian's bookstore on the ground floor of 980 Madison, almost hidden. There was no press release. The inkjet on canvas works were priced at $40,000 each. I liked them immediately. I thought, what a clever idea. These are going to sell like crazy, Gagosian said to me. Prince later testified that he made $45 million purely from sales of his art in 2014, and at least that amount in 2015. Maybe a little bit more than $45 million, he said. The critical response was torrential, every writer feeling the need to weigh in, most of it scathing. Peter Schelsdahl said the show made him wish he were dead, and that counted as a favorable review. ArtNet ran this as a headline: Richard Prince sucks. Jerry Saltz got Prince's bit right off the bat, but his love for the work just reignited the discourse, forcing other critics to respond to him. Eventually, the model Emily Ratajkowski got in on the dialogue with an essay titled Buying Myself Back, a saga of how Prince came to make an Instagram portrait of her that ended up above the couch of an unnamed art boy, forcing her to negotiate to get control of her own image. It's a searing attack on the ex who tried to keep the work, but at the same time, Ratajkowski had a much more generous take on Prince's Instagram works than the art critics were willing to say publicly. "I'd studied art at UCLA and could appreciate Prince's Warholian take on Instagram," she wrote. She was also game to be a part of the whole stunt. Prince's comment on that post, included among several others at the bottom of the painting, alludes to an imagined day he has spent with me on the beach. "You told me the truth. You lost the anchor emoji. No hurt, no upset." "All energy bunny now that it's sunny," it reads, Ratajkowski wrote. "I liked the comment he left on this one far better than his comment on the black and white study, where he says, 'Were you built in a science lab by teenage boys?'" At some point, Prince made an Instagram portrait of Ivanka Trump, who before the 2016 election was a redoubtable collector on the scene, always at openings, willing to take chances on emerging artists and install their works in a building owned by her husband, Jared Kushner. Together, Jovanka had, in the years before the election, built an estimated $25 million art collection with all the trendy stuff at the time. Alex DeCourt, Alex Israel, Nate Lohman, Dan Colin. After she got wind of Prince's Instagram portraits, Trump reached out to the artist via an art advisor and asked if he would be willing to make an Instagram portrait for her. He looked through her feed, found something that interested him, and whipped up the work. Then her father got elected president. The artist revolted, and protests were held outside of Kushner's Puck building, where the couple hung work from their collection in the lobby. DeCourt told Trump to get his work off her wall, but Prince went one step further. He disowned his artwork. When it turned out that he wasn't going to be the closet Democrat that everybody thought he might have been, yeah, I just said something to the effect of, "That's not mine, that's not my portrait, that's not." I can't remember the words that I said, but that got a pretty interesting reaction, Prince said. It was a pretty radical turn. For centuries, patrons who support right-wing causes have been at odds with the artists whose work they collect. For the most part, everyone's gotten along. Just buying an artwork is a big enough gesture for most people in the industry. And to that end, one Prince obsessive said disowning a work, even if it was owned by President Trump's daughter, was a bridge too far. If Prince can say that this person's work is fake, it's a house of cards. And suddenly all artwork owned by those who the artist disagrees with becomes fake. Prince, in hindsight, sees some logic in this. The problem with that type of protest is that when you're in so many collections, he told me, firstly, you don't know who owns your work, number one, and then your work is owned by people who are part of that landscape, and you could spend the entire day trying to deal with that situation. When it comes to addressing politics, Prince thinks his friends Jenny Holzer and Barbara Kruger do it better and do it more consistently. But in so many indirect ways, how he responds to the systems that govern America, he is a deeply political artist, one particularly well-suited for this moment of deep cynicism. He doesn't give an F on one level, and on another, he deeply cares about ethics, democracy, freedom of speech, all of the core values that we like to think are still somewhere buried in this country right now, said Spector. Richard identifies with the hippie drawings. He identifies with 1968 counterculture, anti-war. I mean, that really was part of his intellectual formation. So I think that willingness to buck the system is very, very true to the work. Or, as Prince put it to me, I eat politics, I sleep politics, but I don't drink politics. My experience has always been paint the protest. Prince's work is, at its foundation, honest about the dark underbelly of America in a way that has particular resonance in the second Trump era, especially as the president orders a public institution like the Smithsonian to disengage from narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. When I ask Spector about staging the Prince Jaffa show at a private institution in Italy next year, she said, "I don't think I could make this exhibition in the United States right now." The Trump stuff was nothing compared to the fusillade of lawsuits. As soon as his name got printed next to seven-figure prices, the photographers who took pictures that Prince allegedly appropriated started coming for a paycheck. Prince, via his deposition, commercial photographers are assigned, they are told what to do, and literally after they take their images are art-directed, meaning they are changed, they are airbrushed, they are cropped, they are edited, and they usually wind up looking very little like what the commercial photographer first took. Patrick Carew filed a copyright infringement suit in 2009 over images he took of Rastafarians used in Prince's 2008 series Canal Zone. Prince, on why he wanted to make art of Rastafarians, "I always wanted dreads, but I knew I couldn't grow them. But if I couldn't grow them, I could paint them." Donald Graham sued Prince and Gagosian Gallery for making an Instagram portrait of Graham's portrait of a Rastafarian. Eric McNatt sued Prince and Bloom and Poe for using another image in his new portraits. The process dragged in his gallerist, who spent top dollar for lawyers to defend the artistic process of one of the country's best artists. There was setback after setback, and the occasional victory. In 2013, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that most of the work in the Canal Zone series constituted fair use, a huge victory for appropriation art. At the time, I thought, what an effing pain in the ass. I'm getting sued. But I'm so proud to have been part of it, said Gagosian. It was like, who wants to sit through depositions and pay lawyers? It went on and on and on. But at the end of the day, I'm really proud that I supported Richard. It's not like I'm a hero. I was just doing the right thing. They settled with Carew in 2014 over the remaining Canal Zone works. And last year, Prince agreed to pay Graham and McNatt damages to end those lawsuits. But he also has found a way to incorporate the process into his practice. Even with his prodigious output, he'd never made a film work. He's always admired Warhol's Empire, an 8-hour shot of the Empire State Building. On a Friday morning in March 2018, Prince entered the offices of the law firm Cravath, Swain & Moore in Midtown Manhattan and prepared to be deposed in the cases Graham and McNatt had brought. He sat in front of a camera in a black suit jacket and white button-down shirt, a blue background behind him, and a bottle of Poland Spring water at arm's length. As things got started, a chorus of attorneys chirped in the background, never seen on the screen. For the next 6 hours and 40 minutes, Prince talked. Prince was being sued by two commercial photographers, and like many depositions, it was recorded on video. And while I was speaking to Prince in the Hamptons, 4,000 miles away in Rome, it was evening, and the artwork deposition was playing on a TV set at a gallery in an abandoned church. Was it performative? I mean, that I really can't say. But I did have in mind the fact that at the end of all this, it might be a way of making a movie, he told me. And I always had thought, you know, I know artists have made movies. Lots of artists have made movies in the past. But again, I never had a subject. Watching Prince calmly talk his way through his career while the attorneys bark increasingly absurd lines of attack at him is strangely engrossing, and at times uproariously funny. But at a certain point, the dialogue crosses the Rubicon from surreal and enters into a truly transcendent moment of contemporary art. Just after the five-hour mark, the lawyers slide across the table as evidence an image that Prince had posted to his Twitter account a few days before. Exhibit 187 is a picture of a shoehorn. Prince found it on the ground outside the Met and decided it was art. His art. I realized then they had been trolling me because I had put this image out a couple of days before the deposition, he said, and by put out, he meant tweeted. And when that thing came across the table, I think if you watch enough Law and Order, you're told you don't ask a question unless you know the answer. Well, when they slipped that, they didn't know what the answer was going to be. Prince told me that this, among all over moments, is when he knew that the deposition could be an artwork. Do you recognize Exhibit 187? A lawyer off-screen asked Prince. Yes, Prince says. What is Exhibit 187? The lawyer asked. A good question, Prince says. It's everything. And what do you mean by that? Says the lawyer. It's my entire life, Prince says. What is the photo in Exhibit 187 of? Says the lawyer. It's art history. It's an African mask. It's Cubism. It's a little bit of Calder. It's Duchamp. It's definitely Man Ray. It's a found object. It's a ready-made. It's a nod. Reminds me of a Hans Bellmer. And in a more contemporary sense, and this is someone who really, a very good friend of mine, who's actually having an exhibit at the moment, Robert Gober. So in a strange way, what you're looking at is about 118 years of art history here. He goes on, no one's stopping him. I mean, this is an image that is actually too good to be true. Hard to believe, almost impossible, really real, almost real. It's so real that it's not real. And yet in the end, this is what appropriation is about, he says. It's basically a shoehorn. But is it a shoehorn? It's not. It's not because I say it's not. It's not a shoehorn because I just explained what it really is. I was actually thinking about bringing it here today to explain what appropriation is, he finishes. After this, Charles Munn, a lawyer for the plaintiffs, breaks in unexpectedly, at which point the camera cuts out. I ask Prince what happened during that gap in filming. It was kind of a 15-minute rap about the history of art, and I just remember the lawyer standing up and started yelling to my lawyer, "Can you please tell your client to stop?" Prince said. And of course, I just kept looking at the video. At that moment, it became a little performance. There are many moments like that throughout deposition. There's a digression on whether Andy Kaufman's stand-up act was considered a performance art. There's a long talk about whether taking a screenshot on an iPhone is an act of creative expression. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for the blind and print-impaired community. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.